October 27th, this is Lecture 17, History of the Early Years of the Vietnam War. You should have before you three handouts. A outline of the lecture, a schematic listing the contenders, participants in the Vietnam War, and a very short thing by Jay Myerson called Setting the Stage, a very brief description of 1945 to 1954 period. I think I touch on most of this here, but this sort of fills it in if I don't. Well, you can see from the outline, this lecture covers events of World War II, the Viet Minh War, and the run-up to the Vietnam War. Also, probably next time we'll get into that, early events in the Vietnam War. It does not deal with the 1954 Geneva Conference, which will come later in Lecture 20 on political settlement. All right, the major events in Indochina in World War II. France was overrun by the Germans in 1940 and surrendered. Not all of the country was occupied by the Germans, who were headquartered in Paris. In southern France, around the city of Vichy, famous for its mineral waters, was unoccupied France, its government headed by Marshal Pétain, who was a World War I hero. He and it collaborated with the Germans. In Indochina, particularly in Hanoi, the colonial government became part of the Vichy government. Admiral Jean de Caux was the governor general, and he collaborated with the Japanese. The Japanese invaded Indochina, or to be technically correct, the Vichy government signed an agreement with Japan that they could militarily occupy Indochina. That was in July of 1941. It was a nominal occupation by the Japanese. Through most of the war, the French colons in Indochina continued to run the country for the Japanese. Japan had only about 30, 35,000 troops in all of Indochina, which would average about one per village. Chiefly, they were in the cities and at the cross points of transportation and communication. Japan was chiefly interested in getting Indochina's raw materials, rice and rubber, principally. Allied strategy in World War II was to win in Europe first and then in Asia. Even later, when the war shifted to the Pacific, it was essentially a naval war, except for China, which fought chiefly by itself. Indochina was a distinct backwater of the war. The Allies in Indochina did have contacts with the anti-Japanese forces, chiefly the Indochinese Communist Party. They traded small arms for help in rescuing downed American airmen and for intelligence. There was almost no land combat in Indochina during World War II. In the spring of 1945, the Japanese took over running Indochina themselves, and they jailed the French administrators. This was the so-called Japanese coup d'etat. A few months later, the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, and shortly thereafter, the war was over, August 15, 1945. And shortly thereafter, Allied forces arrived to disarm the Japanese troops and to repatriate them to Japan. The British came into Hanoi, to Saigon, and disarmed the Japanese in the southern half of Indochina, mostly Vietnam, and the Chinese nationalists came in from China in the north and did the same thing in the northern half of the country. Events of all that summer of 1945 were 1945 for Vietnam was one of those seminal years that comes occasionally when history can go one of several ways. David Marr has written a book. He's an American academic who teaches in Australia, called 1945. It's a very big book, but it traces what was going on in Indochina, particularly in Vietnam, during that year. Much of the country at the time the Japanese surrendered, or shortly thereafter, was under at least nominal control of what were called the People's Liberation Committees. This is an organizational structure that had been developed during the war and emerged and came out of the woodwork really in August of 1945 as a hierarchy pyramid, a series of these liberation committees throughout the country, and they were headed as collectively at the top by Ho Chi Minh as chairman. In many areas, particularly in the north, these committees became the de facto government. Through them, and aided by some judicious political juggling, Ho Chi Minh, in what was really the boldest move of his career, asserted his authority over the emperor, over Vietnam. Emperor Bao Dai, who had been there during the war, abdicated in Ho Chi Minh's favor, or what became the Viet Minh's favor, and became what was called supreme advisor to the new government, thus transferring to this emergent regime the mantle of legitimacy. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam was proclaimed August 2, I think it is, or 1, 1945, known in Vietnam today as the August Revolution. The August Revolution was a bold bid for power, but it failed. August Revolution, in truth, as that term goes, is a kind of historical fiction, in that its claim is that revolution was achieved, the people took over, and the DRV became the government, was ensconced in power, and then it was overturned by the invading French, returning French. But most Vietnamese, even those in the south, today, and the historical view is that it was an uncompleted revolution. It is a kind of myth in a way, but everybody in Vietnam tends to believe it. Once I talked to party cadres on at some length at one point in the mid-60s on this. They also believed that the August Revolution would not have the August Revolution would not have been destroyed had the USSR chosen to block the return of the French military forces. They held that Moscow could do this very easily, should have done it, but they didn't do it. And this really colored attitudes in all Vietnamese toward the Soviets. I don't think the Soviets really could do it. They weren't, you know, they're just coming out of a very bad war, and the least of their interest was what was happening in Indochina. But it did color future foreign relations. Ho Chi Minh hoped that the occupying Allied forces would treat him as the authentic leader of Vietnam, a hope that was quickly dashed. This move, however, was wise as well as it was bold, because it gave the Viet Minh, his organization, a momentum that it never lost, and that its nationalistic opponents, the Dai Viets, Cao Dai and others, could never match. It put Ho Chi Minh and his fellow communists firmly at the helm of the anti-colonial struggle in Indochina. So it created, both in reality and in myth, the foundation on which the communist organization mass base could be built. It also provided the communists with an instrument to nullify opposition. Well, they could and did argue that Vietnam must present a united front and speak with a single voice to the occupying foreigners. Gradually, the noose tightened. The British arrived in mid-September 1945 under General Douglas Gracie. and he had orders to disarm the Japanese. And because of poor advance intelligence, Gracie was caught by surprise by the chaotic situation that had quickly developed. French residents in Saigon who had been interned by the Japanese were released, and they armed themselves even before the British got there out of a local arsenal, and they began settling some old scores with the Vietnamese, and Gracie was obliged to disarm them. In addition, an Indian division that had been promised him failed to arrive, so the Gracie forces were vastly under strength. The French General Leclerc arrived on September 23rd, announced at Saigon Airport, "We have come to reclaim our heritage." He quickly disposed of the Southern National Bloc Committee that Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh had set up. He quickly ended the disorders in Saigon. He also put down fairly firmly resistance of the Cao Dai and the Wa Hao sects, who were not at that point part of the Viet Minh, but were still anti-colonial. The then French High Commissioner Admiral D'Argentlou arrived as the sort of supreme commander of the whole Indochina sector. And from the very start, he opposed efforts toward rapprochement between his government, that is the French government, and Ho Chi Minh. And he took strong objection to a basic agreement that had been signed by the DRV, Ho Chi Minh, and the French on March 6, 1946, on the independence of Vietnam, in which the French government recognized the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. D'Argentlou attempted to circumvent this and to form a separate Indochina Federation. The French government, being weak as it was, allowed him to torpedo this March agreement. D'Argentlou perceived the Viet Minh as a small number of dissident intellectuals whose, quote, government need only be compressed geographically and then strangled economically. He was determined to preserve for France at least the rich rice-growing South. So on June 1st, 1946, he announced that in response to popular pressure for autonomy, the government of Cochinchina, which is the southern third of Vietnam, had been established. He hoped to separate Cochinchina from the rest of Indochina and wall it off from the winds of nationalism. He formed what was called the Cochinchinese Advisory Council. A man named Dr. Tran Tan Phat as leader. Phat was shot down in the streets of Saigon within a month. When the representatives of DRV, that is from Hanoi, and the French government were formally meeting at Fontainebleau for the purposes of arriving at an amicable solution, D'Argentlou on his own convened a conference in Dalat, which was made up of representatives from Cochinchina, Cambodia, and Laos, but not the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. That move, in diplomatic terms, was so blatant and obvious it left the DRV representative at Fontainebleau with little choice but to walk out of the conference. Thus it was that D'Argentlou, a mere functionary, scuttled what might have been an arrangement that would have prevented the Viet Minh War. When I wrote the book Viet Cong, it had to be vetted by the State Department, and this little old lady who did that job called me down from MIT and said, we have one serious complaint here about your book, and that is that you call Admiral D'Argentlou one of the great Neanderthals of colonialism. And she said, we're afraid that that will make the French mad. And I said, that's where I got it, from the French. That's what they think today, too. She said, well, okay, then we'll let it go. The problem was that the Quai d'Orsay, as we call it, the government in Paris, was extraordinarily weak during the period of the Viet Minh War and during the period that D'Argentlou was getting away with murder. it was going through one government after another, and a little like Italy did until quite recently. It was so blatant and so frequent that there was a joke around the State Department that the French gave us the Statue of Liberty and we should give them the Empire State Building as a clubhouse for former French foreign ministers and prime ministers. Anyway, I don't mean to put all this monkey on Dartmouth's back, but it was one of those cases that really began in 1945 when Vietnam could have moved toward, away from the Viet Minh War. Ho Chi Minh wanted it, the French in Paris wanted it, the colons in Indochina did not. You have to understand, in colonialism, the colon as an individual is often quite different than the person back in the metropolitan home country. The British is the same true, the Dutch, I think even true of some of the Americans in the Philippines. They live a different life, and they will push policy as far as they can. And if the country, you know, the leadership back home is weak, then they keep pushing until they get what they want. The Viet Minh War. Viet Minh's strategy sought, first of all, it was an internal war more than as much as it was a war against colonialism. It sought to nullify opposition within itself and within the anti-colonialist camp. It was, as I think I have told you, a front organization, which is a technical term. It's an organization of organizations. There are about a half dozen or maybe eight major organizations that were members of the Viet Minh. One of them was the Communist Party. Others were not communist. There were Catholic battalions of the Viet Minh who were distinctly anti-communist, but they were also nationalists, they were also anti-colonialists. So the Viet Minh strategy was to nullify any opposition to the communists within the Viet Minh, as labeling it an anti-colonialist activity, and then to build a responsive machine to organize, energize the people, and isolate the colony, chiefly by organizational means. Controversial domestic issues, and there were many among the Vietnamese, were avoided wherever they could. Also, the campaign of denigration against the anti-colonialist leaders, whether they were nationalists or monarchists, was accomplished with a kind of scalpel rather than a broadsword. There were some bloody moments when General Jacques' goons had a night of long knives in Hanoi and took out all of the key anti-communist nationalists. Not all of them, but all of those that were in town. And it badly weakened the leadership. It also left quite a message anybody who wanted to oppose Ho Chi Minh for whatever reason. Anyway, this didn't bother other people, particularly ordinary Vietnamese, because this was a kind of resultant political mix. It was palatable to most Vietnamese, what the Viet Minh were doing. And it won support for most of the Viet Minh. I think most of the Americans in Vietnam at the time were quite sympathetic to the Viet Minh. In Vietnam, even later in the South, when we were doing research, it was quite clear in the questions that you had to, that the term Viet Minh and patriotism were more or less interchangeable. And any kind of question that suggested otherwise would get a static or an argument from whoever you were interviewing. It was mostly in the villages. All right, just a bit now about the French presence and the lead-up to the Viet Minh War. Saigon's main street was called when I was there, it was called Tudo, T-U-D-O, which means freedom. Formerly, it was called Katina, C-A-T-I-N-A-T, Katina, which was the name of the ship that brought the French army to the city in the first place. In many ways, this street, Tudo, it symbolizes France and Vietnam. It begins at the Saigon docks and it ends at a square dominated by the largest Catholic cathedral of Indochina, one that's reminiscent of the one at Chartres. So the street is only a few blocks long. It's a pleasant avenue lined with tamarind trees, full of sidewalk cafes, bookstores, shops filled with imported goods, and a few bars and nightclubs. So it was really trade and religion that brought the French to Vietnam, and it left a style of living and an influence of foreign ideas. It was also very short as time goes in Asia. But French colonialism also left a heritage of bitterness and hatred that I think is worse or more extensive than that found in other ex-colonies in Asia, in Indonesia with the Dutch, India, Malaya, Burma with the Brits, the Americans and the Philippines. That's sort of ironic because during their brief sojourn in Indochina, the French prided themselves on their unique relations with their colonies, the limbs of mother country, France, l'Outre-mer. And they felt more of a closer identification than I think most other colonials did. British were fairly racist in their attitude, or what we today would call racist. The French were. So the aftermath of this has left a very psychic scar on France. There have been a few books on this, but very recently, on memories of Indochina by people who were there. And it's some of them are very emotional. And it's a characteristic with some colonials. They fall in love with the country. They go native, as they say. In the Foreign Service in Washington, out at Arlington, the training school for Foreign Service, they have several lectures they give you on how you mustn't go native, how much you mustn't come to identify yourself with the country that you're in. You're out there to represent the United States and American interests. You're not out there to represent the interests of those people that you're dealing with. Well, that's easier said than done, because once you're there, you identify with them, you criticize some of your own policies, and it doesn't seem to happen to the British. They can be there 20 years and they're just as stiff-necked Brits as they ever were. Dutch, I think, are more like the Americans. Anyway, it left a kind of particular scar, a bitter, sweet memory of Indochina. That a lot of the French literature set in Indochina captures this. There's a new novel out in which about these Catholic missionaries who arrive in about the turn of the century, and they set up this missionary operation in the highlands, and they go native, really. I mean, Rome, the Vatican, is completely put out with them for what they're doing. They try to pull them home, they don't come home, and they try to get the French government to do something about it. It won't do anything about it. It's fiction, but the description of these relationships are really quite, quite telling. All right, say a bit about the strategy. I'm not going to say much about the day-to-day battles of the Viet Minh War. As battles go, they were more or less like any battle, any war, really. The further you get from any battle, the less significance it has, generally. Few exceptions, but not many. But the Viet Minh strategy really consisted of uncovering specific truisms. Some of these were Ho Chi Minh's insights. Some were stolen from experiences of other guerrilla organizations. Some from the Chinese, quite a bit from the Chinese. And all of these had been tried and tested somewhere. If you go through Viet Minh history, I did at one point, I tried to draw out what seemed to be the essence of the Viet Minh strategy, which you understand is military and political, and is much, probably more political or more off the battlefield. One, don't try for too much. Don't try to smash the existing social system, but use it. Don't destroy opposing organizations, take them over. Two, use the amorphous United Front to attack opposition political forces that are too large or too powerful for you to take over. Then, fragment their leadership, using terror if necessary, and drown their followers in the massive front organization. Three, at all times appear outwardly reasonable about the matter of sharing power with rival organizations, even while secretly working to, by every means possible, to eliminate them. And do not posture in public. And that was very wise, and Ho Chi Minh followed that rule very closely. Four, divide your organization rigidly into overt and covert sections, and minimize the traffic and intercourse between the two. The overt group's chief task is to generate broad political support. The covert group seeks to accumulate and manipulate political power. Five, use communism as dogma. This is party instructions, stressing those aspects that are well regarded by the people. Don't hesitate to interpret Marxism-Leninism in any way that you think will prove beneficial. Soft pedal the class struggle idea, except among your own cadres. Six, don't antagonize anyone if it can be helped. This forestalls, is mostly talking about Vietnamese, not French, this forestalls the formation of rival blocs. But even there, the Viet Minh made a serious effort to cultivate supporters in France, the left and the center, by portraying the unreasonableness of colonialism, by pointing out other colonial countries in Asia were abandoning colonialism. Only the French were hanging on. And that found a fairly widespread sympathy in France, although not in the government. Seven, bearing in mind that Vietnam's altruism is conspicuous by its absence, blend the proper mixture of materialistic appeals of communism, land and bread for the people, traditional ones, with the larger one of nationalism. Plan to, in the end, to win not as communists but as nationalists. This is one of those historical arguments. Can you be a communist? Are you a communist or are you a nationalist? Was Ho Chi Minh a communist or was he a nationalist? It's a false question, because you can be a communist and a nationalist at the same time. Makes for an interesting term paper if you want to be a political science major. I will talk more about communism as a motivating force later in the year. And finally, there's nine here. Use the countryside as a base and carry the struggle to the city later. In rural areas, political opportunities are greater and the risks smaller. Avoid, this is the cadres, avoid the lure of the tea house, that of sitting around drinking tea and plotting revolution. Now, Mao is supposedly the person who came up with the idea of ridding revolution in the rural area, in the peasant, as opposed to rooting it in the proletariat in the cities, which was what Karl Marx said. You don't have a proletariat factory people are being ground down, you don't have the makings for a revolution. It does appear that the Vietnamese were, this was also going on in China at the time, of course, this people's revolution, revolutionary guerrilla war, but it does appear that the Vietnamese were as were into this earlier and were as good at it and were as experienced as were the Chinese. All the Vietnamese military, and one the old generals you meet in Jap and others in Hanoi, of course, will tell you this. Everything about revolutionary guerrilla war, we invented. Chinese never invented anything. Chinese are a nation of farmers. What do they know about guerrilla war? We've been fighting guerrilla wars for 1,000 years, mostly against the Chinese. Well, they have a point. The problem is they don't ever write this down. They don't have a paper trail on it that scholars can trace, and the Chinese do. So it's a matter between those two communist parties anyway. And finally, forge a city alliance, even though this is rooted in the peasantry. And you must try to mobilize both the farmer and the worker to make a farmer-worker bond. Work from the small to the large, from the specific to the general. Work from small, safe areas out in the boondocks to larger liberated areas. Then expand the liberated areas. You begin with small struggle movements and work toward the general uprising, which is in which state power will be seized, which is something of a social myth. Most of these precepts show the influence of Ho Chi Minh, who was the primary genius in the field of organization. In the earliest days, when he worked with Michael Borodin, a famous Russian theoretician at Whampoa in China, Ho had been fascinated by social organization. It was clearly that the clandestine cell structure of underground communism, rather than, say, dialectical materialism, is what attracted him to the cause. Most of his political victories in the pre-Viet Minh days were the result of his skill in creating, using, and propitiously merging a succession of United Front organizations, each upon a plateau higher than his predecessor, each increasing the party's power, broadening its mass base of support, and eliminating its rival. The Viet Minh organization was subsequently abandoned and was drowned in a larger social organization called the Fatherland Front. This was much later. And that gave way to a still larger United Front organization. The whole principle of this is you get organizations as organizations into this political movement and then you manipulate them. It takes some real doing, but if you can pull it off, it really works well. Ho's technique involved enfolding a rival organization into a broader social community. That was a means of obscuring its individual identity and as a prelude to amputating its leadership, after which it disintegrated and became part of the broader, this is called organization slaying. It wasn't new in Vietnam or unique to Vietnam. It happens in this country with third-party political movements quite commonly. Commonly, the Viet Minh War was referred to as the resistance. This is a term, of course, drawn from France, I suppose, the resistance that existed in occupied Europe under the Germans. It was a good term to use because it's more palatable, particularly in France. We talk about the resistance in Vietnam, it conjures up a much brighter image than simply the Viet Minh. The Viet Cong, or National Liberation Front, which followed, was very similar to the Viet Minh. It was obviously patterned after it. Both of them were intimately bound up with the mobilization of people. Both required outside aid, but they differed in three significant ways that make meaningful parallels between the Viet Minh and the Viet Cong that came later. First, the struggle in the South had a distinct imported quality about it that did not characterize either the Viet Minh War or the Communist Revolution in China, but did characterize the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. This was not simply a matter of outside aid or leadership. It was, in essence, an expansionist drive by the North Vietnamese. This is why the Cochin Chinese and the Annamese tended to see it, in central and southern Vietnam. Is also the goal of the North Vietnamese, of the Viet Minh, was unification of Vietnam under their banner. This was legally and morally justified, but it was not seen that way by the Southerners, who tended to see it was simply more Northerners coming down here and pushing us around. So they soft-pedaled this notion in the South. Viet Minh War was anti-colonial. It was clearly nationalist and concerned all Vietnamese, even if they didn't participate, North, Center, and South. Where the Viet Cong, a struggle in the name of reunification, was regarded by most of the Southerners as being neither nationalistic nor patriotic, or not even understandable in their interests. A rural South Vietnamese whose sense of national identification was low could see for little benefit in reunification to him. Second distinct characteristic was part of the outgrowth of the first. The fact that the socio-political factors, including communication of ideas, loomed far larger during the Viet Minh War. A guerrilla might get ambush, the headlines, but it was the Viet Cong village agitprop meeting that did the most to move the cause to victory. And a far greater premium was placed on organizational route to power by the Viet Cong. So it was a war conducted by other means to reverse von Clausewitz. The indifference of the villager to the abstract cause of reunification forced the Viet Cong to concentrate on local complaints, local grievances, as a means of winning village support. They would isolate the grievance and make proposals to end them. And this was something that could be evaluated and understood by any villager. And when these legitimate grievances did exist, as they did under Ngo Dinh Diem, the villager was inclined to support the Viet Cong. But even the Diem government accepted the Viet Cong principle that the fight was to be carried on in the social arena for the loyalties of the rural people. That's something the French never did accept in the Viet Minh War. Even if often misdirected, massive GVN governmental efforts were made in the fields of social welfare, community organization, and communication of ideas. And finally, the Viet Cong at all times publicly fostered the social myth that not by military assaults in the third stage of guerrilla war, but by the means of general uprising. Koinia. That's what Kapina and Tuzov Street, downtown Saigon, has been renamed. Koinia, general uprising. That's the way victory would be delivered. So the whole technical scenario of the process of how the Viet Minh War would unfold and finally end was not the scenario that the Viet Cong ever offered. The third basic difference was the social milieu of the struggle. The fact that the Viet Minh War, great fact of that war, was the French presence. They were there. To the Vietnamese, the French colonialist was a assertive and proprietary foreigner who imposed restrictions that added up to a condition of discrimination, second-class citizenry, which they were basically helpless to oppose. That condition was essentially absent later in the South. If there was political discrimination. It wasn't the foreigners, the French or the Americans that were doing it. It was the local government. And because of their efforts, particularly under American pressure, to try to redress these grievances and meet the complaints of the villager, it had at the very least engendered a kind of sense of confusion. Maybe they didn't really believe that these well-dillers and school textbooks and so on were done because there are lots of nice people in Saigon. But it did muzzy the thing over. I mean, you did wonder why they were doing it. And with villagers and traditional people, they don't expect anything from the rich and the powerful in the capital, and they're seldom disappointed. And when these things do come, they're skeptical as to the motives. And of course, the Viet Cong cadres are in there and say, you know, they're just drilling these wells to win your temporary loyalty. So accept them. We don't care. We believe in drinking water. Tell them to drill 5 more wells or 10. But it does leave there is a kind of firm memory that is left. I've been out to, since the war, out to Vietnamese villages in the south and talking to villagers and get around to the American pet. Were there Americans around here? Oh yes, there were a lot of them around here. Well, they were in a camp over there, but they'd come through the village and so on. Sometimes they'd be chasing the Viet Cong. And they said, what do you remember about this? You remember the battles and the... Well, not very well. What do you remember? Well, I remember they came in and put a new roof on the school. And the Koreans came in and built a Buddhist temple. But that's about all I remember. Now, that's a memorable thing to villagers because they're not used to that sort of thing. And warfare they're used to. They're not sure who is fighting whom, and it's just kind of a vague... And it was a quiet war. There weren't battle. If there had been a big battle in the village, of course they would have remembered that. But statistically, you take any individual South Vietnamese and say to him or to yourself, how much actual bloodshed, warfare, gunfire did this guy ever see, experience, know about? And if you happen to be in a village where they had a big fight, then the answer is very... But statistically, it would work out to about 1 out of 40 had ever really heard a gun. This is in southern Vietnam I'm talking about, where they heard a gun fired in anger. It was a quiet war, and oftentimes the violence that fell on them was the Viet Cong coming into the village and saying, you people are cooperating too much with the GVN, and they shoot the village chief. As I said, their principals, they kill the very best and the very worst of the local villagers, which I think simply further confuses the villager. Why? They can understand maybe why they killed the district, the village chief, but why did they kill the school teacher? He was apolitical? Well, because he was what sociologists call an influential. And people go to people like that in village traditions for opinions and judgments and so on. And this guy didn't like the VC and he didn't make any efforts to hide this. One of my mementos that I have over at the archive is an onion skin death notice with 2 little pinholes in it. It was found pinned on the shirt of this school teacher I knew outside of Saigon, a very nice, harmless little guy. But they came in and had a trial and said they had all this secret evidence of how he was supporting the other side and his intelligence agents, and so they shot him. There was no truth to this. I checked it out. He did not work for the CIA. He never told anybody anything. He was very apolitical, actually. But he was a person, an influential. This is a sociological term, in particular in traditional societies. But there are certain people, sometimes they're official, sometimes they're not, to whom people turn, to people ask for advice and solicit information and so on. And those people were just death to the Viet Cong, right? And it wasn't a political thing at all. It was simply they were one of the natural leaders. I remember I was in a theater, we did motion picture, we did newsreels that went into all 300 Vietnamese theaters across the country. And I remember, and I sometimes when I was in a small town, I'd drop in and sit in the back and watch this, the newsreel, and try to get a sense of what the audience liked. What they liked was pictures of skiing. They just, you know, they all sit up, oh, look at that, they're skiing, you know, in Canada. Well, some have never seen snow, and the idea of you're on these boards, and you're... We also did, when we were doing interviews, we had people outside the theater, and say, did you see this the newsreel? Yes, so can you remember what you saw? Well, I saw this skiing. Anything? No, that's about all I remember. How about 5 minutes of Noda Zim speech? Oh yeah, that was there. I forgot about that. Anyway, one of these, when I came in, there was an audience was sort of crying or moaning or, they were emotionally aroused. And the thing was just, that segment was just over. And I couldn't remember, even though we'd made it, what it was. So I went back to, when I went back to Saigon, I looked it up. And it was a story about the killing of one of Vietnam's best athletes. He was